Hey, everybody. Welcome to Movie Crush, the continuing Casey on Kubrick series, which, by the way, is not stopping.
Ooh, okay.
I say we do, well, we'll talk about that at the end.
Yeah, sure.
We'll pick out a new movie.
Yeah.
But this week, we are going to be covering Eyes Wide Shut, which was Casey's number three pick when this was only supposed to be a three-episode series.
Right, right.
I watched it last night again.
Mm-hmm.
Seen it. I feel like that was probably like my fourth time.
How recently had you seen it before this most recent time?
It had been a minute, but not like 10 years.
Okay,
like,
okay.
I'd seen it within the last 4 or 5 years,
gotcha.
I think. And then saw it in the theater when it first came out. And we'll talk about all this, but it was a movie when it came out at the time. How old were you?
I was,
what year was this, 99?
Yeah, 99, and I think it came out over the summer. So I was 15, about to turn 16, so I actually did not get to see this theatrically.
Okay.
And it's the only Kubrick movie that I was like aware of and knew about as it was being made, as it was like about to come out. So that was kind of disappointing to not actually be able to go see it in the theater. I have since seen it theatrically probably 2 or 3 times. But
oh, okay. Yeah. At a screening.
But like much later in life, like
sure.
in my 30s. So,
yeah. Well, which is probably about right.
Yeah.
What do you
do
at 15 with this movie?
I mean, I loved it. I loved it at the time. By the time I saw it, you know, it came out on DVD like the next year.
Yeah.
And I was impressed with it right away. But certainly it's something that has, I understand it much more now.
Sure.
And my appreciation for it has only grown with age. So.
Yeah, but it was a movie. Where I was going with that was, it was a movie at the time, and I don't know how much you were keeping up with stuff as a sophisticated 15-year-old that you were, probably keeping up with it pretty well, but it was, its legend was so large
before
it was even released.
Yeah.
Because it was Kubrick's follow-up to, I guess, Full Metal Jacket?
12 years.
Yeah, 12 years. Yeah. He had, you know, all these dumb stories about him being in seclusion.
Exactly.
Which, if you talk to Kubrick, he was like, I wasn't in seclusion. I was like, living my life and working on stuff. And,
yeah, he basically, I was watching.
But he wasn't a hermit.
Yeah, I was like watching some documentary stuff yesterday, and one of his daughters put it really well. She was like, he talked to everybody. He just didn't talk to the press. But
right.
like.
That's
he was still a person.
You.
You know,
he's a hermit because he's not doing interviews.
Most people don't talk to the press. So it's just like he was just like a normal person.
Yeah, know? I remember Terrence Malick when before he started making a lot of movies again in a row.
Yeah.
They asked him, I think it was right around Thin Red Line, what he had been doing. And he said, you know, there's really something to be said for not making movies.
Yeah, yeah.
Like,
oh, he had a whole life between, you know, Days of Heaven and,
But you get the sense from the press with people like Malick and Kubrick that they're these weirdos holed up in a castle somewhere.
Exactly. And like to be fair, like the lack of communication from their side just fuels speculation and so on, which is fine. But,
they're just like, fuck off.
It's like, you know, there were stories of people in London, for instance, who would pose as Kubrick, who would, you know, around and introduce themselves as Stanley Kubrick and sometimes they would be believed. There's like a whole movie made based on this premise with John Malkovich playing the impersonator called Color Me Kubrick.
Right.
Yeah.
Did you see that?
I didn't see it. I never saw it. Yeah.
Interesting. But the legend of this movie was so great. And at the time, it was Kubrick's big movie comeback. And the legend of the movie was so large going into it that I remember when I went to see it, there was so much anticipation because it was the longest film shoot in history.
Yeah.
And it brought Tom and Nicole to the brink
of
their marriage and of their life and their sanity. And like, you just heard all these rumors and stories. And finally, I remember sitting in the theater just being like, I have no idea what I'm about
exactly.
to see.
Exactly, yes.
And I think when I saw it, I was a little disappointed, but have since grown to love it more and more.
Yeah.
But it was because of the buildup, I think.
Yeah, exactly. It's not the movie that, you know, anybody really thought they were going to get necessarily.
Yeah.
And there were all these rumors during the production because, like, Harvey Keitel was originally going to be in it.
Right.
And I mean, they shot with Keitel.
Yeah, and he just, like, tapped out, didn't he?
Yeah, I think, you know, depending on, like, what source you're looking at, some put it down to just the fact that the shoot went on for so long because they started shooting, I think, in November 96. And they wrapped in like May of 98, I want to say.
And it's supposedly a 6-month shoot to begin with.
Yeah,
which
yeah.
is a laugh.
And so, you know, it's Kubrick, so you kind of have to be available the whole time because he's shooting scenes and then 4 weeks later he looks at the edit of it and says, oh, I feel like we didn't get that the way I wanted it to. Let's do it again, you know? So, you know, some of the explanation that has been given is just that it was a schedule conflict thing.
Mm-hmm.
These are working actors. They have to
sure.
go out and make a living. They can't, you know, they're not Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman who can afford to, like, do a movie for
yeah.
not a ton of money probably for, like, 18 months or something.
Yeah, he well, I pulled this great. Did you read the Vanity Fair article, by the way?
I did not. Well, not recently anyway. I've probably read it before. But.
It was 15 years later, so I guess it was about 4 years ago.
Okay, I have not read this.
The great Amy Nicholson, who is co-host to the Unspooled podcast, which mm-hmm. I love. Hoping to get Amy on the show one day. But she wrote this great article 15 years on, kind of a retrospective. And there's a lot of cool things in here I'm going to kind of pull out here and there. But it's insane the amount of time it took. Like, for instance, the scene with the sex worker, mm-hmm. Vanessa Shaw.
She's great.
Was supposed to be a couple of weeks, and they shot that scene for 2 months.
Yeah.
That one
That's
scene.
That's amazing.
Like,
well,
how do
it's
you
a great
that?
Scene, but yeah, I don't know how. I mean, I think it is this sort of – Kubrick was at a place where he was, like, doing iterations of scenes where, you know – it's not just that, like, the coverage took that long to shoot or something, but it's that they probably did a whole version of it. He cut it and then looked at it and mm-hmm. thought, let's do something different, you know?
Yeah,
even at the level of changing things about the background, the lighting, you know? One comment that I saw, it was somebody talking about, you know, the high number of takes Kubrick would do, and they said sometimes it wasn't at all about performance.
Mm-hmm.
It was just that he would look at the playback and then say that ashtray is, like, facing the wrong direction.
Oh, God damn it.
And it'd be like, okay, give me one exactly like you just did, but we're going to fix that ashtray issue and go again, you know?
Yeah.
So,
oh, man. Yeah. I mean, well, to clear it up for the listeners, Harvey Keitel was playing the Sidney Pollack role.
Yeah. Yeah. Victor Ziegler. Yeah.
By the way, Sidney Pollack just.
Oh.
I love him so much as
yes,
an actor.
Yes.
I mean, he was such a legendary director, but some of my favorite Sidney Pollack work is as an actor.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Husbands and Wives is
yeah.
one of my favorite
yeah,
roles.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And Emily and I still quote that outline in Husbands and Wives when he's dating the younger girl at the party and she embarrasses him and he drags her out of there and he goes, "You're a fucking infant." So we always quote that
man.
Line. But He said Sidney had the thing. He said the rest of us poor bastards were able to get 16 weeks of filming for $70 million with a $20 million star. Somehow Stanley worked it where he could get 45 weeks of shooting for $65 million. He just said he figured out a way to work in England for a fraction of what we pay here. So
yeah.
I guess it's just he Kubricked it.
It's just, yeah, I think it's the same reason that people do, like, Malick's films where
yeah. –
you know, George Clooney will show up for, like, two lines in Thin Red Line or something.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. And with the possibility of being cut entirely.
Yeah, exactly. Like what happened with Adrian Brody on that movie. So
yeah, he wasn't in it, right?
barely. And he was supposed to be the star. That's
yeah.
a whole other story.
So interesting.
And he didn't find out till the premiere.
Oops.
but yeah, I think Kubrick was in that very, very rarefied air of director that actors will basically just say yes to.
Yeah.
And sort of, like, move things around in their schedule, do whatever it takes to basically get in a Kubrick movie. Because, I mean, like we were saying, it had literally been 12 years just about. I mean, when they started shooting, it was 96. So Full Metal Jacket came out in 87. So it's been mm-hmm. like 9 years, but still almost a decade since the last movie. And
yeah.
just
there's a lot of anticipation.
A lot of false starts and uh-huh. anticipation. And yeah.
Well, Cruise is on record. He said his quote from this article was, I remember talking to Stanley and I said, "Look, I don't care how long it takes, but I have to know, like, are we going to finish in 6 months? Like, I have people waiting, I have writers waiting on other things." So I say, "Stanley, I don't care. Like, just tell me it's going to be 2 years." And he wouldn't do it.
So
and I think
funny.
That's part of the and Amy in this article, too, goes on to talk about the process of, you know, very famously, like in one scene where Tom Cruise walks through a doorway,
mm-hmm.
he had him do that 95 times. And she said it was a concerted effort on Kubrick's part to break them down
yeah.
to nothing.
Yeah.
So they would have to build back up again and forget that they were working on a movie, essentially, that they were so sort of
yeah.
crazed and tired.
Well, there is, like, an amazing kind of home movie quality to Eyes Wide Shut. Even though you're working with, like, two of the biggest movie stars in the world,
yeah.
and it's this highly anticipated project, just the way that Kubrick pared down the size of his crew,
oh, really?
The way he was shooting with, you know, not available light. I would never say that about his approach, but yeah. Certainly we'll get into more of this later, but the way the movie's lit, it's a lot of practicals. It's a lot of...
It was lit by Christmas tree.
Yeah, exactly. So
so beautiful.
You know, it has this very, like, even in terms of, like, the amount of grain that's present in the image,
mm-hmm.
it, you know, it's 35, but it feels almost like 16 sometimes because it is a little bit noisier than
yeah.
we're accustomed to seeing in, like, a big budget movie.
Yeah, for sure.
There's, like, a real, like, handmade quality to this film, I think.
Yeah.
That gives it that super personal, super kind of, like I said, handmade quality.
Well, and I think I didn't see a ton of, like, Kubrick's known for those just super long tracking shots mm-hmm. and dolly shots.
Yeah.
And there's not a lot of that in there.
There's, like, some Steadicam, but that's about it. Yeah, I don't think he ever does
a little bit
any,
of handheld,
like,
but not
I mean,
much.
There's like, a handful of dolly shots when it's, like, Tom Cruise walking down the street, and there's those shots mm-hmm. that are where the camera's kind of parallel to him.
Yeah.
But, yeah, other than that, it's just about all either very, very cleanly done, handheld
yeah.
kind of operation, or Steadicam or tripod.
Yeah, I know the handheld is most notable to me in the scene. The really long scene where, I know that doesn't narrow it down, but the really long scene with Nicole Kidman.
The argument, yeah.
Yeah, the fight scene that yeah. really kind of sets up his yeah. whole left turn into yeah. His weird, weird night.
Yes.
There's a lot of handheld in that, and that scene is long and should have been long and mm-hmm. fits, and she's so good.
Yeah, when she's, like, doubling over with laughter, the way the camera
oh
just
God.
Pans down, and the operation's incredible because
yeah.
it's, like, her timing and the way the camera just follows her immediately, they're, uh-huh. like, perfectly in sync.
Yeah.
And you can tell that probably took who knows how many takes or days to get that.
Well, and then
right.
with her performance, like, knowing that she did that God knows how
yeah,
many times.
Yeah, and still feels completely fresh. And
so real.
Yeah.
And Cruise, I think, in that scene, he got hammered in the press, and I didn't realize how widely his performance was panned. But I mean, listen, Tom Cruise is a world-class flake when it comes to Scientology and things like that.
Right, right.
But I think the guy is a legendary actor.
Oh, yeah.
And an
yeah.
amazing actor.
And if you look
at... As much
at,
as I hate to admit it sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you look at his great. Performance in, like, Magnolia from right around the same time.
Yeah.
Like,
Frank
he
T.
can
Mackey.
He can bring that realness and that intensity and so on.
Yeah.
And really kind of disappear into a character and play against type and all that kind of stuff. He's completely capable of doing that. So I think, you know, whatever else you can say about Eyes Wide Shut or about his character, his performance, and so on, like, it's exactly as it was intended by Kubrick.
Yeah,
you know?
Like, Dr. Bill is a very reserved guy.
Yeah,
like, he doesn't outwardly emote much.
No.
There's a lot going on in his being.
He's meant to be kind of an everyman, kind of just an average guy
yeah.
in a way. Although he's you know, he is a doctor. He's, like, upper middle class, but
he
at
wields
the same
that
time,
doctor
like,
card like a badge.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's
but
so funny.
You know, at the same time, he kind of... you know, he goes home, he sits down on the couch, he watches football and has, like, a Budweiser, like,
yeah,
which to me, those shots are always so funny to me because I don't completely buy Tom Cruise as that.
No.
Every exactly time, as that,
like,
guy.
Both times that he opened the Budweiser
yeah,
can,
yeah.
I was like,
come on.
Yeah.
He's not doing that. But that is his character. That's what Kubrick is kind of going for, is, like, this sort of just middle of the road,
yeah.
you know, very mainstream kind of guy.
Which is weird that he cast Tom Cruise.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
That was probably part of it.
Well, that was always his kind of idea, I think, was to work with these, you know, somebody that was super well known. Like, even the character's name, Harford,
mm-hmm.
was, you know, basically a reference to Harrison Ford.
Oh, really?
Not that he wanted to cast Harrison Ford,
uh-huh.
but just this idea of, like, leading man, you know, somebody who can, like, mm-hmm. hold a movie and is, like, well known to people as this Hollywood kind of royalty,
yeah.
But at the same time, is going to be put in this role and kind of play against type. And
yeah. he doesn't do a lot of. He's so into. I mean, I think the Mission Impossible series is pretty great,
mm-hmm.
But it seems like he's sort of only playing those roles now.
Yeah, he's kind of like he had that more kind of, you know, take me seriously as an actor phase.
Yeah.
And it does seem like now he's kind of moved beyond that where he's more interested in maybe like doing the practical stunts himself. And
I wonder,
you know,
if it's because he's getting
like
older. He's like, this is my last shot.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I'll have
maybe
final
we'll
third
get,
where
yeah.
we go back to.
That would be incredible, actually. I'd love to see that for him to like kind of do like a late life
yeah.
turn back to like
he's gonna have
heavy,
to.
Serious drama kind of roles.
He can't keep jumping off of buildings.
True, yeah.
You know?
breaking his legs. Yeah.
And it also dawned on me, like, Nicole Kidman, she has become one of the best actors of her generation.
Fantastic. Yeah.
Like when you look at her body of work, and especially lately,
yes,
she is just in great movie after great movie now.
Yeah.
You know?
One of my favorites of hers is Birth. Have you seen Birth?
No.
Jonathan Glazer film?
Nuh-uh.
That's almost another one like to do like an episode or something about. But it's very Kubrickian.
Uh-huh.
And it has this incredible scene of Nicole Kidman sitting down in the audience at like an opera performance. And it starts on this extremely wide shot, and it's a slow Kubrickian zoom all the way into a close up of her face. And you're hearing the music, there's no dialogue, but you're seeing these emotions play out over her face, unbroken take.
Oh, wow.
And you see this entire emotional transformation and realization and reckoning, and she breaks down into tears. And it's one of the, you know, greatest like single shot performances of any actor I can think of.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I'm gonna check that
out. She's amazing.
So this movie is about... it's about marriage and fidelity.
It's about a lot, yeah.
But it kind of hit me more than ever last night. It's really about sex in almost every way.
Yeah.
Like every character in this movie almost.
They're driven by
some sort of sexual transaction.
Yes.
Or sexual tension happening. And obviously with the Illuminati fuck party stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's the obvious thing. But like the Alan Cumming is the hotel desk clerk.
He's hitting on him hard.
Is just like eating him alive with his eyes.
Yeah.
And the two women, the two models at the party early on.
Yeah.
Are just writhing and like it's so sexual.
Yes.
Like they're practically dry humping him in this party.
Yeah.
And the guy, the bear and the Hungarian.
The Hungarian,
whatever. Yeah. Emily last night, by the way, does not love this movie.
Uh-huh.
She just kept yelling things at the screen while I was watching it. But she was like, dude, get out of her fucking face. Like he's just so predatory.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The whole movie is... like when he rents the costume, that could have just been a very simple costume.
Right,
model.
Right. But
yet
it's a
they
whole
throw in this
other
whole thing with
crazy
the daughter,
thing. The daughter, yeah.
Pimping out the daughter, these Asian guys in drag.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
just there's sex everywhere.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, even the patient's house that he goes to and she confesses, you know, supposedly that she has this
that
love
she loves
for him.
Him.
Yeah.
And he's like, what are you talking about?
He's like, I don't even, we've never had a conversation outside of your father's health, you
let
know?
Let me ask you something. With that character, later in the movie, after, I think it's...
Oh, he calls again.
Yeah.
And I'd forgotten about that scene.
I did too. What is that? Is he trying to reach her?
Yeah, I think
why?
He's sort of like, I've struck out here.
Is that the deal?
And he's kind of like, well, I've got this other kind of like iron in the fire. I could maybe rekindle and...
Because is that your take is that he has, once he learns that he... about Nicole Kidman's story about the naval officer.
Yeah, yeah.
And even though nothing happened,
right.
He is not the center of her life.
Yeah.
Is he trying to get laid?
His whole worldview has been rocked.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I don't know if he's like single-mindedly, if that's the only thing that's motivating him is to go out and have sex with somebody.
Revenge
but,
sex.
But it's definitely a strong element that's mixed up in there where he's trying to sort out his feelings of jealousy and betrayal and, you know, just like he was so secure in what he thought was, you know, his marriage and his relationship and so on. And to have that certainty just completely demolished.
Yeah, man. And the brutal, like, if you men only knew.
He just doesn't know what to do with that.
What a line.
He doesn't know how to handle it. So I do think that was his motivation for calling back. And then, of course, when it's the boyfriend that comes to the phone in that second... scene.
Which pulled me out, by the way, because that fucking guy from Dharma and Greg.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, that'll date a movie.
Yeah. That's
like,
true.
That guy.
I didn't recognize him, but now that you say it, I totally get, that is him.
Yeah. So she tells him that she had this fantasy of this naval officer.
Yeah.
Kind of destroys his world because he very sort of, I don't know if it was cocky, but just very confidently was like, well, of course I know you've never cheated on me.
Yeah. I think that's what bothers her is that he is so sure of it.
Yeah.
That it shows in a way, even though what he's trying to say, I think, is that he trusts her. Mm-hmm. He has confidence in her. He just wholly believes that she would never do anything to hurt him in that way.
Right.
But there's still kind of like, you still want to have that 1 or 2% of like a little bit of jealousy just because it shows that you care in some way, you know?
Well, and it's also the message he sort of delivers is like, you are not a sexual creature
except men are.
Through me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like, you know, men, yeah, we all know what men are like.
Yeah.
You know, because you're a beautiful woman, therefore he definitely would have wanted to sleep with you.
Uh-huh.
That's like the only possible motivation a man would have hit on you or talk to you or whatever. He's like, that's what men are like. But, you know, women are different. They're, he doesn't say this, but the implication is like they're more maternal, they're more domestic, they're more like, you know, their sexuality is not so like wide open as a man's is. And she wants to tell him, like, don't be so sure of yourself. Like,
because this thing happened.
Yeah, because this thing happened. And
I really wanted it to happen.
Nothing came of it. But, you know, if things had gone a little differently, maybe it would have happened. And she still remembered it however many years later.
Yeah, and that's what drives his, like, every action from that point forward. He's obsessed with this.
Yeah.
And I should mention that the one part of this movie that I really still don't like was the flashback to the naval officer.
I agree. Completely.
The way he shot it was very – it dates it. It looks very 90s.
Yeah. It's and just like not the Kubrick. The, what do you call that method? The step printing, I guess.
Yeah.
The kind of the – you know, it's shot at like 12 frames a second or something like that.
Yeah,
you know?
It just didn't fit Stanley Kubrick's style at all.
To me, it's kind of like the best way I can like sort of rationalize it, I guess, is that he's trying to visualize – the kind of, I don't know, old-fashionedness of these visions that Tom Cruise is having.
Yeah.
That he's having these very almost kind of, because, you know, it's, I guess we'll talk about the source a little bit, but it's based on this like 1920s, you know.
Oh, I know nothing about this.
Novel by Arthur Schnitzler, which is set in the Vienna in like the 19th century.
Oh, interesting.
So it's, you know, you've got kind of like Freud, you've got kind of, repressed sexuality playing in there quite a bit more. And I think it's something the reason those shots of the naval officer Nicole Kidman are so kind of like corny feeling.
Yeah.
I think is almost that he's going for this kind of old timey feel. But I agree, it's completely, you know, that's not what, you know, like an American man in the 1990s would envision, you know, it would be like softcore porn or something, you know, would be more the visual style to go for.
Yeah. And evidently, Kubrick, you know, rather purposely tried to, fuck with Tom and Nicole's marriage
during that scene, especially.
Yeah.
But not allowing Tom to be on set.
Yeah. Didn't let him be on set. Yeah. Wouldn't allow her to say what happened. And then, evidently when they shot it, spent a couple of weeks for what ended up being seconds of flashback where he put them in, it said, in more than 50 erotic positions. And just like, this is, I think, where all of the Kubrick thing came to such a head of him being a manipulator as a director.
Yeah.
Because they suffered, and they both are on record in this Vanity Fair article about how – it really, the lines became blurred, and it really did fuck with their marriage.
Yeah, yeah. Something I was watching last night, Nicole Kidman talks about what really excites her about performance as like an actor. And she said it is those moments where the line between your personal life and your character start to blur, and you can't see that line anymore. She said it's a very exciting thing. It's also a very dangerous thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Cruise, well, here's the deal. Everyone knows Tom Cruise is, like, regardless of what you think of his talents, he is one of the hardest working actors.
Absolutely.
At his craft.
Yes.
He is very well known for just, and it's not just like, hey, I do my own stunts, but like, we'll do anything to nail his part.
Yes.
And now he's working with the master of all time, but not necessarily known for being the master director of actors.
Right, right.
And he wanted to please him so much.
Yeah.
He got an ulcer during the filmmaking, but would not tell Kubrick about it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he didn't want to give him that.
Yeah.
And then Todd Field, who's great in this movie, is
Nick also had an ulcer. Or I think Todd Field's ulcer came later when he was dealing with the studio on either Little Children or In the Bedroom.
Yeah, where did he go? Those were great movies.
I know. I love those, both of those films, and he's a great actor in this movie, too. I really enjoy his performance. But I distinctly remember reading about Todd Field having to go back and forth with maybe it was Harvey Weinstein or somebody, but
really?
It was kind of a nightmare producer scenario, and he just got like a massive ulcer from the stress of that situation.
Well, he, as a director, he certainly knows what he's talking about, but he said that he said, "You've never seen two actors more completely subservient and prostrate themselves at the feet of a director."
Ooh.
Than Tom and Nicole did.
Yeah.
And I believe it, that it was working with Kubrick, and there were rumors already that this could be his final picture.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Tom and Nicole were at a place where they, like you said, he could afford to take off that time and not make another. He probably lost
20 million.
Out on,
yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Probably two times 20
yeah.
million.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
With the time it took.
Right, right.
But I could see them being just like, we'll do 1,000 takes, Stanley.
Yeah.
If that's
yeah.
what you want.
Yeah.
Because you're a genius.
Yeah.
And he was, it's like, oh man, I've got these two.
Yeah.
I could so fuck with them, and I am going to.
I was reading or listening to something where the cinematographer Larry Smith said something to the effect of Kubrick didn't do as many repetitive takes on this film as he had on other films.
Oh, interesting.
Maybe because Tom and Nicole were more prepared than usual. Yeah, he said that some scenes would take 2 hours and some would take 2 weeks. But but there, you know, Kubrick had maybe backed off a little bit on that sort of almost compulsive urge to like, you know, at least on certain scenes anyway.
Right. And then others, he walks through the door 95
times. Of course, yeah. You know, we talked about how on Barry Lyndon, you know, Leon Vitale only had to do the vomiting scene once, you know.
Oh, right, right.
So it could be something like that where he just caught such a natural reaction of Tom or Nicole that he was like, we're never going to do that better. Let's move on. But I still need you to walk through the door 95 times or whatever.
Vitale's in this too, right?
He's the red-cloaked mastermind of the ceremony, of
so
the orgy.
He's, remove your clothes.
Exactly, yeah. He's the one who speaks. Yeah, yeah. Ask for the second password and all that.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. We'll get to stuff because, goddamn, man, what a interesting turn that movie took.
I know, right?
So Sidney Pollack, I love it at the beginning of this movie. He's got this Christmas party.
Oh.
And then the next thing you know, he's with a sex worker who's shooting up a speedball in the upstairs room.
Yep.
And she's like basically dead. And Tom Cruise revives her just by saying, you know, open your eyes. Look
at me. Yeah, Mandy, open your eyes.
Yeah, which is kind of interesting. But God, Pollock is so good.
I love Harvey Keitel, but I'm so happy that it ended up being Pollock in this film because Pollock just has that like Hollywood royalty.
Uh-huh.
He's very charismatic. He's very like, he's somebody that, you know, you would feel completely comfortable like letting him watch your kids or something.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he also has this kind of like, he's played so many roles where he's like the older kind of corporate guy or whatever, who like knows where all the bodies are buried. And, but in a very nice way at the same time. So he's such a wonderful stand-in for kind of what I think Kubrick is kind of gesturing towards, which is this idea of like old money, old power, kind of like, just like the American aristocracy, kind of. He's like the perfect symbol of that. Whereas Keitel, I think, is a little more eccentric, a little more like uncontrollable, and you know, just wouldn't,
not as stable for sure.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think he would really read nearly as well in that part.
Yeah.
And while I'm thinking about it also, the other actor that was either replaced or had to leave, Jennifer Jason Leigh, was going to play the daughter of the patient who passes away, who confesses her love to Tom Cruise.
Yeah, I didn't know that actor who played her in this. I don't
know that she's done. Yeah, I'm not familiar with her either.
She looked a little unhinged.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But that's just interesting. Those two, you know, didn't make it through the production.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
So,
but going back to Sidney Pollack and the party and all that.
Yeah. Well, I think after the big night out.
Yeah.
Which we'll talk about in greater detail.
Yes. Yes.
He comes back and the whole next 30 minutes or so is him sort of trying to undo the things. Or like, he literally goes and checks in on every...
Kind of retraces his footsteps of the night before, but now it's daytime.
He finds out Nick Nightingale, he believes, has been abducted and killed.
Yep.
He finds out that... which is funny, too, because Alan Cumming in that scene, he's like, did you notice anything weird? And he's like, well, just these nine things.
Funny you should ask, because actually, you know, he had a black eye, and he had these intimidating guys around him, and they whisked him away, and they said, you know, we're going to forward his mail and all this kind of stuff.
And Tom Cruise is being flirty back in that scene.
Yeah, yeah.
I think because he wants to get what he wants.
Exactly, yeah.
And he knows that this guy's just like, you know, licking him up and down with his eyes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Did I say licking or looking?
He sounded like he said licking,
probably
actually.
Probably either one.
Yeah.
But he finally gets to Sydney Pollack once he finds out that the woman from that OD'd that tried to help him at the party
goes to the hospital
is
and
dead.
Sees her in the morgue. Yeah.
And Sydney Pollack's like, first of all, like, you don't want to be asking questions.
Mm-hmm.
And second of all, like, nothing is wrong.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nick Nightingale's with his family. She just OD'd.
He's talking out of both sides of his mouth.
Yeah.
He's like, you've been way out of your depth for the last 24 hours.
Yeah, but I don't know what to trust, though, as a viewer still.
Well, I think that's deliberate on Kubrick's part.
Yeah.
I really became way more conscious of the kind of dual reading you could have of, like, the last 15 to 20 to 30 minutes of this movie.
Is Nick Nightingale dead?
Is Nick Nightingale dead? Maybe he is. Maybe
because
Tom Cruise doesn't have, like, a phone number you can call him at.
So...
maybe he really is back in Seattle, you know, with Miss Nightingale, or maybe he's not, you know.
And maybe they OD'd the woman.
Yeah, yeah.
Like,
well,
I could see all that happening.
Somebody pointed out that, you know, when Sydney Pollack is talking about that in particular, he's like, hey, the door was locked from the inside. The police are happy. There's nothing to see here. It's like—
he doesn't quite say why, we didn't
why
do
does
it.
Sydney Pollack know the circumstances of the scene quite so well?
Like, the rest of that sentence could very well have been, because we came in through the window
and
killed her.
Yes, yes. So there's that. You know, there's when, you know, as Tom Cruise is going to leave, Sydney Pollack says something to the effect of, but of course, you know, life goes on.
Yeah.
Until it doesn't. You know that, right, Bill? You know,
yeah.
You know that better than everybody. You're a doctor.
Is that a threat?
It's a threat, I think.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. But he's smiling and he's happy when he says it. But
he's Sydney Pollack.
He claps Tom Cruise on the shoulder and Tom like flinches.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's like, you know, he's facing away from him and he makes this face like he might have been expecting a knife or something.
Yeah.
So... and of course, the very next thing you see is the mask sitting on the pillow next to Nicole Kidman.
Right, with the implication that she found it where he had hid it or
that's
not.
That's the thing.
Or did someone place it there?
It's so carefully constructed, the what they say, what they don't say, how they react to everything. You could read the scene probably in more than two ways, but the two that jump out to me are either he forgot the mask somewhere in the apartment, she found it, and knows... you know, not exactly what happened, but she has some idea that he hasn't been telling her the truth about where he's been going at night.
Yeah.
You know, so she's put it up there on the pillow as like an accusation. That's one reading. The other reading, of course, is that this secret society has broken into their apartment, put the thing on the pillow while she's asleep,
which is so fucking
just
creepy.
as a kind of like poke to say, we know where you live. We have access to your family.
Yeah.
Anything can happen to you if you keep pushing on this thing.
Yeah.
So just forget about it.
Because he had gotten that letter that, you know, basically said that.
Give up your inquiries, which are worthless.
Yeah, which are worthless
And just go away. Go back to your little life, you know?
Oh, and those dudes, since we're on that.
Oh, that face, the guy.
Yeah, the henchmen's, the guy that delivers the letters, the two gentlemen that greet him as he arrives at the party at the gate, like, so Kubrick.
Yes.
They only exist in the world of Stanley Kubrick.
Absolutely,
because in any other movie, they would be these... big, like, muscly henchmen.
Yeah, yeah.
But in Kubrick's, they're like these 60-something-year-old British men who look like they've killed 1,000 men.
Which is, it's very, like, takes me back to, like, The Shining or something.
Absolutely.
You know? Which, you know, I mean, it's, this is getting off track a little bit, but I think this movie has a lot of connections thematically with The Shining, with the idea of the Overlook Hotel representing some kind of, like, older power that's been... around for generations, you know, not only in America, but in England as well.
Yeah.
The kind of like colonial empire power. And I think, you know, when he's giving them the tour of the Overlook Hotel and he says, all the best people stayed here.
Yeah, yeah.
Like Sydney Pollack's character is also, quote unquote, all the best people.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's that same class of like the 1%. What do you want to call them, you know?
Yeah, Kubrick loves that world.
Yeah, and Barry Lyndon, yeah. Very much the same thing, where it's like you see him ascending the ranks and starting to rub elbows with these people. Uh-huh. And again, like in Barry Lyndon, even though he's risen to a certain level by marriage, he still kind of has his low status in the kind of final view of things, because he doesn't have a title, he doesn't have proper ownership of this estate. And so when he is introduced in that one scene to the king, all the king says to him is just kind of like, good, raise up a company, go fight the American rebellion, you know? And it's like, to the king, he's nothing, you know? And even though he has status relative to his, like, his servants and so on, he's ultimately a nobody in the grand scheme.
Yeah.
And it's the same with Tom Cruise in Eyes Wide Shut, where it's like, he's a doctor, he has this nice apartment, he's, you know, his status as a doctor does kind of grant him access to, he can move in the world, you know?
Well, that's what I'm saying. He flashes that doctor
like
card around.
It's like a detective.
Yeah,
you know?
Like a badge, like, I'm a doctor.
I mean, that, you know, I think writers have talked about, especially the detective story, as a way for a character to kind of traverse the whole spectrum of, like, from the upper crust to the underclass, you know?
Yeah.
They can move throughout these different worlds, and it's a way for writers to kind of depict the whole kind of variety of people and statuses and classes in society. The his sort of medical license is kind of like his version of the badge in Eyes Wide Shut.
Yeah.
He's able to, you know, he's able to check in on a body at the morgue, but he's also able to, like, get a costume at 3 a.m, you know, like, he can, it allows him to kind of move through society. But ultimately, when he comes into conflict with somebody who has real power, Sidney Pollack character, he is, like, put in his place very quickly.
Yeah, and feels like a pawn.
Yeah, which he is.
Yeah, in a larger game that he has no idea even about.
He didn't even know it existed.
Yeah.
You know, he just catches this glimpse, like this whole other subterranean world that he had no idea existed. And, you know, when in the final scene of the film where Nicole Kidman, or I think Tom Cruise says to Nicole Kidman.
We're in the toy store?
Yeah, in the toy store. He's like, what are we going to do?
Yeah.
Which, again, could be either about, what are we going to do in our marriage? Mm-hmm. Are we going to stay together? Are we going to split up?
That's how I read it.
Or what are we going to do? We've been threatened. They've been in our apartment.
Well,
they know
who
we are.
He tells her everything. Yeah.
Yeah, he tells her everything. And you really could read it either way of, like, was it a dream? Was it reality?
Yeah.
Is the reality of one night, what is that next to an entire lifetime in a committed relationship, versus what is the reality of one night where you are exposed to this creepy, you know, secret society versus the world you've known the rest of your life, you know? Was that real? Was that imagined? Was there really a sacrifice? Was there not?
Yeah.
He's really playing on this kind of duality of, like, dream versus reality on multiple levels. And again, like I said, they don't tip their hand as to exactly what it is they're talking about in those final scenes, which
is for sure.
Really, really well done.
Well, I think for Nicole, she's talking about – she takes it as the marriage, I think, for sure, because it very famously ends with, you know –
there's one important thing we have to do.
Yeah. What's that? Fuck.
Yeah. I love that fuck is the last word in any Kubrick film. You know, it's like the cap on the careers.
Yeah. Again, fuck. With the sexuality. I mean, not only with all the characters, but at one point he's driving in the taxi and just looks out the window and sees that couple – like looking like they're about to have sex on the street.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's just everywhere. It's just soaked through this movie.
Yeah.
And right after Nicole, you know, tells him the big story with the big fight, which, by the way, it's like, I don't think you have to be married to get that, but that was such a marriage thing to, like, get in a fight, to almost pick a fight because you feel like fighting.
Well, it's like when Tom Cruise has that great line.
What are
we
even doing?
Exactly. He's like, I don't even know what we're arguing about.
Yeah.
She's like, we're not arguing.
That is,
you know,
marriage to a T sometimes.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just take it out on the person closest to you,
absolutely,
whatever mood you're feeling.
Most of the time.
And that's sort of what's happening.
The worst of you. Yeah.
But this sends him out. Well, he does get the call to go see.
Yeah, it is true. He gets like
character.
A nudge. He does have to go out. Like, he doesn't just leave.
He leaps at the chance,
though,
when this sex worker on the street basically says, you want to come upstairs?
Yeah.
Which, by the way, I wasn't even totally convinced she was a sex worker.
I think she was.
Was she?
Yeah.
Because I almost was like, for some reason last night when I saw it, it had the read to me of, she just thought he was cute, asked mm-hmm. him upstairs, and then all of a sudden it became a money transaction.
No, because I think, you know, when she does kind of like approach him on the street.
Yeah,
and
true.
She's using coded language because, you know, he.
Like, you want to come upstairs.
Yeah, well, it's like, you know, you want to come inside. I live right around here.
Yeah.
We could like go inside and get more comfortable, something like that. It's warmer in there than it is out here.
Yeah, that's true.
I think.
But
I mean,
she has
to
this
me,
roommate.
It reads as, yeah, she has a roommate, but I think they're both sex workers, probably.
Oh, okay.
Or maybe, that's how I read it anyway. That also, I mean, the Vanessa Shaw character, she might also be like a student. There's like a whole other, this is like a bigger topic we can get into more later, but when Tom Cruise takes the phone call from Nicole Kidman,
yeah.
he walks over by Vanessa Shaw's like bookshelves. And there's this book facing out that says Introducing Sociology.
Yeah, yeah.
And I should mention that Introducing Sociology is also the name of a fantastic essay on Eyes Wide Shut by a critic, Tim Kreider, K-R-E-I-D-E-R, which you can find if you just Google Introducing Sociology Kubrick. It should come up. But it a lot of this kind of class-based analysis of the movie comes from that essay, and so I definitely want to encourage anyone who's interested in this kind of line of thinking about the film to check that out, because it's one of the best pieces of writing on this film I think I've ever encountered. So I think the idea is that maybe she's like a student at NYU, but she's also doing this on the side,
right.
pay for tuition, you know.
Maybe so. Because that's what it feels like. They feel
yeah.
like she, feels like a couple of
college
students.
Yeah, I don't think she's like... You know, she doesn't read as like a sort
walker.
Of tragic streetwalker that's
yeah.
like hooked on drugs or something like that. She still seems like she's kind of, you know, somewhat educated, somewhat like from probably a middle class kind of background. But she's chosen this line of work.
Right. Or maybe that's just how Kubrick portrays the sex worker
it
in his
be,
world.
It could be, yeah. Yeah.
But when he comes back to – it's interesting. When he comes back the next day and he's kind of retracing his steps, there is like a negative consequence – on everything. Like
yeah.
he goes back to see her. First of all, he walks in a very bizarre scene, just meets this roommate
yeah.
and is practically having sex with her.
Yeah, yeah,
within
yeah.
within a minute.
Yeah.
He's like, there's just this crazy tension going on.
Which is why I took it to mean that she was also potentially a sex worker and that she had heard from her roommate that
really handsome doctor.
This is a really handsome guy, nice guy.
Yeah.
You
rich.
Know, We didn't even have sex and he still paid me,
yeah,
all
yeah.
this kind of stuff. Like that's probably – she was probably charmed by him,
right.
you know? And so that's why I think – and the fact that Tom Cruise knows that she knows he was already there to pay for sex anyway.
Right.
I think kind of like –
he still hasn't gotten laid.
It's like an icebreaker between the two of them
yeah.
where it's like immediately sex is kind of on the table. It's
yeah.
like a possible thing because they're having that conversation about like – she's out right now. I don't know when she's going to be
yeah,
back, you know?
She may not come back at all.
And like they're in that narrow kitchen and she has to kind of scoot by him at the table.
Yeah.
And they're like just a couple inches apart, you
oh,
know?
Yeah.
They're kind of rubbing on each other. So, I you know, the sexual tension you cut with a knife for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the consequences overnight,
yeah.
He learns that the other Vanessa Shaw is
yeah.
HIV positive.
Yep.
So... it's this weird thing where it's like it's the movie is all about sex, but there's always this negative consequence.
Well, that's the Victorian kind of like, you know, 19th century, like the sort of like repressed
yeah.
vibe, you know, the kind of Freudian vibe of
well,
like,
which came from the source
yeah,
material.
Yeah,
perhaps.
Yeah, exactly. Like this idea that, I mean, that was kind of Kubrick's idea. I think was his thesis was sort of that, you know, relationships. Sexual relationships, romantic relationships had not perhaps changed so much
mm-hmm.
since that era that we flatter ourselves sometimes as living in this like modern enlightened kind of world, but
yeah.
maybe it's a little more old school and kind of still like repressed and kind of, you know, just not as modern or as sophisticated as we might think.
Yeah, because his, he's portrayed as sort of repressed.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily sexually, but like there's that one notable shot of or sequence of him doctoring. And, you know, it goes from like a little kid to like an old lady to one of those
yeah.
Kubrickian models.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Naked.
Yeah.
And it's all very just
matter of fact.
Clinical,
yeah.
which is what he swears is the truth to
mm-hmm.
Nicole. Like,
yeah.
the last thing on my mind is ever this. And yeah. he portrays that on the screen.
Yeah.
So that is the truth, it seems like. But apparently a lot of stuff was cut out of the original script where he struggles with
interesting
the sexuality of his patients.
Interesting.
And there was a voiceover, too, that was cut out.
Wow.
Like a Tom Cruise voiceover that talked a lot about, like, how he was feeling.
Interesting.
Which I would be really interested to
That's fascinating.
Kind of see that.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. You know, I'm thinking about that sequence where you do see kind of like Tom Cruise going through his day at work.
Yeah.
That's also intercut with Nicole Kidman at home, largely, you know.
Yeah.
Teaching her kid.
Yep. Doing the mommy stuff.
Doing the mommy stuff. Uh-huh. It's like all the domestic labor. And I think that's a really interesting kind of scene that, because I think it's a very, very deliberate thing the movie is doing, showing that they're both working, even though she is quote-unquote unemployed, even though she's
right.
a homemaker, mother, whatever,
yeah.
that they're both performing labor. They're both, you know, kind of playing a role in society and that they're both kind of workers in a certain sense.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I mean, that's a whole other thing, just Nicole Kidman's place in the relationship mm-hmm. as somebody that has – she had an art gallery, but it went under –
Right.
She's not working right now.
Yeah.
She's kind of like a kept woman. She's kind of like the trophy wife or something. Uh-huh. You know, the first line of dialogue that Tom Cruise, first line by anybody in the movie is, "Honey, have you seen my wallet?"
Right.
So if you reduce it to that,
when
Tom Cruise is like
naked.
The wallet. He's the breadwinner
yeah.
And so on, the provider. One of the first things that Nicole Kidman says, I mean, she answers him. She says, like, it's on the bedside table. She has a few, like, incidental lines. But the first line she has when the camera follows Tom Cruise into the bathroom is, "How do I look?"
Yeah.
So it's like money and looks
yep.
are like the two defining aspects of both these characters, that she is her kind of job, quote unquote, is to be beautiful
uh-huh.
and to kind of
go to these parties,
raise his child, you know.
Right.
And his job is go out, do the doctor thing, you
uh-huh.
know, provide this big apartment. And,
yeah.
you know, that is they're living in a very traditional, old school kind of single income
yeah.
family kind of style.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really interesting. Because like the mundaneness of that stands in stark contrast
yes.
to this night that he has.
Yeah, exactly. He's like he's coming from the most kind of cliche, normal
uh-huh.
middle of the road average kind of existence.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they are living in New York City, so it's not like they're like in the suburbs or somewhere rural, which
right.
maybe even be a little bit more to that, you know, common lived experience.
Yeah,
but
it would have been a little on the nose.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I'm kind of surprised it wasn't like, you know, a Connecticut suburb.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So he's still, you know, he's a little more urban.
Yeah.
He's a little more like, he kind of moves in these like, slightly more rarefied circles, but
yeah.
he's basically an upper middle class guy.
Yeah.
And, but he has access to this, you know, more kind of rarefied air.
Yeah. It's interesting. He's always in a suit almost, unless
mm-hmm.
he's like in bed or something.
Yeah.
But then that last bit, pre Toy Store, that last next day scene, basically
yeah.
after he breaks down and says, "I'm going to tell you everything."
Yeah.
There's three things that you don't see at all in the movie up until that point. You see a Christmas tree turned off in the background.
Interesting.
And throughout the whole movie, they're just beaming with
yeah,
light,
yeah.
colorful light.
Yeah.
Christmas tree's turned off. Nicole Kidman has no makeup on.
And her eyes are red from crying.
And he
yeah.
is not in a suit. He's wearing like a shirt and a sweater.
True. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's – they never look more – their life never looks more ordinary
yeah, yeah,
than
yeah,
in that
yeah.
kind of stripped down – scene at the end, which
yeah.
I thought was really interesting.
I love that. Yeah, I love the effect that he creates, because he's going from one of the more hyper-stylized scenes in the whole movie, the way the bedroom is lit when, you know, when it's night and he comes home and the mask is on the bed.
Yeah.
And you have that amazing piano track.
Oh, God. Yeah,
that
we need
single
to talk about
note, the score. Yeah.
Ding!
Yeah. Oh, terrifying.
Ding,
yeah.
ding!
Ding, 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 ding.
It's really... It gets under your skin
yeah, yeah.
over 2 hours and 40 minutes or whatever.
And him breaking down and just weeping and saying, "I'll tell you everything, I'll tell you everything."
Yeah.
And then that hard cut to Nicole Kidman, red-eyed,
yeah.
smoking. Looks like they probably have literally been up all night, you know, shooting this thing.
Yeah. I mean, he reeks of exhaustion through the whole movie.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he, I don't even know if he It never shows him going to sleep, does it?
I mean, it seems like certainly that second night, it seems like neither one of them slept after he got home.
Because he gets home at what? He said it was like 4 a.m.
Yeah, yeah. And it's early morning. It's probably 2-3 hours later at that point.
Yeah.
And she says, you know, our kid's going to be up soon. We promised her we'd take her Christmas shopping. So we have to both kind of like collect ourselves, you know, get our shit together and like present the outward appearance of like normal, stable parents again.
Is this a Christmas movie, Casey?
Yeah, it's a Christmas, it's a total Christmas movie. I think it's the Christmas movie, actually.
Well, let's talk about the lighting a little bit.
Yeah.
Beautiful. I mean, I think Stanley Kubrick set it at Christmas just so he could use these lights.
Well, I think this is derailing us a little bit from cinematography, but the choice of Christmas, I think, is extremely important thematically as well. Just because what is Christmas? Christmas is this sort of like consumerist ritual that we have in American society.
But it's really a pagan holiday.
Yeah, it's really a pagan holiday. And, you know, on the one hand, it purports to be about Christianity, religion, you know, all that. But at the same time, it plays such an important part in our economy where like the fourth quarter for retail especially is just like it is where you make your money for like the whole year kind of if you're in certain business. So it's this duality of American society that we put kind of like more of like a meaning on certain things, but underneath it there is just this kind of like brute consumerist capitalist kind of thing happening. And I think that's kind of a metaphor for like the whole film if you think about it in terms of like just the performance of like the idea of like the masks that everybody wears.
Yeah.
The metaphor of the mask at the orgy is just the most literal version of the mask that everybody is wearing at different moments in their lives when they're performing, you know, when he's performing the role of a doctor as opposed to the role of a husband, as opposed to the role of a father or something.
Yeah.
You know, like when Sidney Pollack and his wife greet them as they come into the Christmas party, they're performing the role of this like you know, older married couple, very successful. You know, they probably have a whole kind of philanthropic kind of presence in the world where they're like at these award galas and so on, you know, giving to charities and so on. They probably have like a very respectable name and place in society.
Oh, for sure.
And then not 10 minutes later, he's upstairs with a hooker ODing on a speedball and, you know, he's pulling up his pants and he's like,
I know.
This stays between us. It's like there's always multiple levels of reality happening at the same time.
Yeah.
And I think the Christmas is definitely a deliberate choice, not just for the kind of visual possibilities, which it absolutely does afford.
Oh, man, it's so
but
great.
Also because it does comment on it's a way of extending that duality to like American society.
Yeah, I mean, the lighting, the use of Christmas, the colored Christmas lights on the trees, all of them are colored lights, and then those gorgeous walls of string lights in Pollock's apartment, and then even then, like, it's so funny, so, like, over-stylized, but the costume shop is, like, so gorgeous.
Oh, it's incredible,
and, like, he has this almost museum, and I feel like it was a little Barry Lyndon nod, because there's that one outfit on the mannequin, like, from the colonial era or whatever.
Yeah.
But, it's such a like this is not what a costume shop would look
No.
Upstairs in the Greenwich Village.
And you could say the same about New York as a whole because, you know, getting back to Kubrick's kind of quote unquote reclusive style, he refused after a certain point reportedly to like fly on airplanes.
Yeah.
Which whether he actually did or whether he just
wanted to stay in England.
Yeah, just wanted to say, I want to have a rock solid reason for why I can never fly to LA or something, you know.
So I'll tell them I won't fly.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Kubrick got his pilot license at one point. So, you know, he was very familiar with aviation.
Yeah.
And so it's not that he was averse to the idea of flying. It could just be that once he saw kind of how the sausage was made from a flying standpoint
in Hollywood,
he didn't feel comfortable, you know, getting on a commercial plane where you don't know who's piloting the thing. He knows how much can go wrong or something. But
yeah, it's interesting though. Like he very famously recreated Greenwich Village in London and sent his assistants to
Like a whole second unit go to New York. Yeah.
Yeah. Like apparently like measuring the distance between newspaper boxes to get it perfect. But it doesn't feel like New York, though.
No.
Like when I was watching it, and I think that I wasn't
Some of it's London, like the scenes where you see, again, where it's those tracking shots of Tom Cruise from the side walking down the street.
Uh-huh.
apparently some of that is actually like London streets.
Right. But it doesn't ever feel like New York to
me. And when
even though it's dressed up like New York.
Even when it's the straight on shots that are tracking back with Tom Cruise, mm-hmm. where you see the background, you know, behind him and he's directly facing camera, those are like rear projection plates
that
were actually shot on the street in actual New York.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, and Tom Cruise is just on a treadmill and they're basically like, you know, they're projecting this image of.
And the car scenes too, right?
Yeah. I think Kubrick was going for a deliberately stylized, deliberately dreamlike.
I think so.
It's New York, but it's not quite New York.
That's
kind
what
of feeling.
That's what I took from it last night, because I was like, I've been to New York so much since I first saw this movie.
Yeah.
I was like, man, that's.
You never see those.
It's so
streets.
Not New York.
Yeah.
But it gave it this off-kilter feel.
Mm-hmm.
Right down to like, you know, the gang of toughs that basically kind of call Tom Cruise gay.
Yeah.
And it's
that's a very interesting scene.
Like it borders on a hate crime.
Oh yeah, totally.
And Cruise, you can tell, is like, I kind of want to, like, to me, I was like, Ethan Hunt these motherfuckers
now. Well, it's so interesting because that is so against his usual persona.
Yeah.
Where he is the one who acts on the world and, you know, rises to, you know, kind of strike back against opposition and so on.
But he had
he's outnumbered. Like,
I think he did the
10 to 1.
I think he was like, all right, that's way too many guys.
And he's just like, I'm going to get my ass kicked if I even do anything. So all I can do is just suck it up and, like, you know, just take it. Just try to, like, move beyond it.
Yeah, but it fits because it's a movie so much about his sexual frustrations.
Right.
Because he's always striking out.
Yeah.
And then in that scene, he's basically, his masculinity is called out.
Yep.
But he can't do anything about it.
Can't do anything about it.
So once again, it's another form of sexual frustration.
Yeah.
Just piling on him.
Yeah. He's just getting dumped on left and right in this movie.
All right, let's get to the orgy.
Yeah.
The movie takes a very strange turn when he meets up with Nick Nightingale at the Sonata Club, which, again, looks like no jazz club in New York ever.
Incredible looking. Yeah.
He tells him about this crazy thing. Like, you wouldn't believe it. They blindfold me. I'm paid to play the piano. Yep. But the blindfold, like, you know.
Last time it slipped off a little bit and I could see what was going on.
And so he gives him the Fidelio password, which I've used that as a joke a lot. No one ever gets it.
Yeah.
I'll bust that word out, and everyone's like, what? Did you say fellatio? So he goes to this mansion, I guess, in Connecticut or upstate or somewhere.
I think it's supposed to be like Long Island or something, like way out somewhere, yeah.
And all of a sudden, it's this it's this Kubrickian, like, nightmare.
It's like the most uncanny, like, nightmarish, bizarre, surreal thing.
And you know, even before you're fully told by Sidney Pollack later, you know that there are very important people behind those masks.
Yes.
And that it's very secret.
Yeah.
And everyone keeps telling him repeatedly, like, you have no idea what kind of danger you're in.
Yeah.
Like, these people will fucking kill you.
Yeah.
So the secret doesn't get out.
This is the idea is just sort of like, these are the people who really control society or something, you know? It's like, what do they want to call it? Like the Illuminati or the 1% or the elite
Secret
or whatever.
Society, yeah.
It's just kind of like, these are the real movers and shakers in the world who, you know, the president takes their phone calls and, you know, kind of takes his marching orders from what they're telling him, you know?
Yeah, but it's so weird to, like, part of me is just kind of cracking up at it last night. Like, all they're doing is having sex.
Yeah.
But it's couched in all of this weird ceremony.
Right.
With the women in the circle that, which, by the way, like, the uniformity of their bodies and their body types.
It's a very specific type that he kind of went for. Yeah.
Freaky to me.
Yeah.
Tall, broad shouldered.
Yeah.
And they all are obviously purposely cast to be these nameless sort of replicas of one another.
Yeah.
But, like, what was going on there? What the fuck was that all about?
It's very, very eerie.
Or just don't question it. Is it just to set a tone?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it almost feels to me like they have, like you said, they've all been chosen for a certain kind of physical uniformity. But there's just something so ominous about that because
it was terrifying.
The uniformity of it just implies that they've probably had to go through so many more, like, where are they finding these women? Like, what happens to the ones who don't make the cut?
Right.
Like, It's just very, very, very odd.
I love the one line it reminded me when Tom Cruise is like, because yeah, they're like, you know what this means if you take his, if you take this on for him.
Yeah.
She's like, yes, I do.
Yeah.
And Tom Cruise with Sidney Pollack is like, what the fuck happened to her? And he was like, she got her brains fucked
exactly,
out.
Exactly.
Same thing that happens every other night.
It's like, yeah,
it's like, that's it.
We put her in a car, sent her home. She was fine.
Yeah.
It was there was nothing wrong with her.
But
you know?
I don't think I believe that for a second.
Well, he says, he's like, it was only a matter of time. It was the same one you already saw OD that one time at my party.
Right.
So I think he's really leaning hard on the fact that
she was a junkie.
This is somebody that would have OD'd at some point anyway.
Yeah.
So what's the problem if we sped that up a little bit,
right.
If we kind of slid the timeline up a few months or whatever.
Yeah.
That's kind of what he's saying, I think. He's like, don't look at this as somebody who has lost, another 50, 60 years of their life or whatever.
Anyway,
he's just kind of like, she was already headed for the grave. So what's the big deal,
Well, what I want to know is how did he get found out? We know that he got found out with a password and the fact that he arrived in a taxi the fact that he had a receipt in his pocket.
The thing is, he didn't get found out from the password, though, because there was no second password.
Right.
So
he
password,
said, at the end, that was what sealed the deal.
Yeah. There was no like when he said Fidelio, that was the correct answer. But it was more the fact that he showed up in a taxi, whereas everyone else showed up in a limo.
Right.
Which is kind of, you see a little bit of that, economic kind of class divide there. The fact that when they took his costume, there was a receipt from the rental shop in the pocket. So they also knew that this is something
you don't own. The
cloak. Yeah. You don't own it, and you just did this 10 minutes before he got here, kind of thing.
Well, how is he found out to her though? Because he enters, sort of pretty quickly gets paired up with her.
Yeah,
and she's like, what are you doing here? How does she know?
Maybe it's
that's the one part I couldn't wrap my head
around. The choice of mask, or just the fact that he's arriving later after everybody else is there.
But she's it's clear.
Yeah,
and he gets. I mean, you get that first great Barry Lyndon.
Push in
of the two creeps in the upper floor,
which is probably Sidney Pollack and somebody.
Yeah,
has been suggested anyway that they had this crazy bloodshot eye that you can kind of see through the mask. But I think the implication is that that's Sidney Pollack kind of clocking him as he comes in, realizing, if not that it's Tom Cruise yet, at least realizing there's somebody here who doesn't belong.
Yeah.
And we've all kind of picked up on that. But we're going to kind of, for now, hold our breath and just kind of see what happens. Yeah.
And so he wanders around this party. And is it – I think I remember that there were digital people added – In front of the sex scenes?
For the American version, the theatrical American version. The reason for that is, we haven't talked about it, but Kubrick died literally within days of finishing his kind of final cut of the movie.
Because didn't he edit this forever too?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think because they wrapped up shooting in early 98 and it didn't come out until summer 99.
Right.
So it was a good year plus of post-production.
Did he have anyone in his corner saying posthumously saying you can't fuck with this movie?
Yeah, well, the thing is that Kubrick had Final Cut with Warner Brothers.
Yeah.
But he also had in his contract, because of the nature of the film, because there was going to be some sex in it, he was contractually obligated to deliver an R-rated movie. So it's you can make, it can be as long as you want, you can have whatever scenes you want, but you have to get an R from the MPAA.
Right.
We can't
go NC-17.
Put out a $65 million, NC-17 movie. It just won't work.
Right.
For any number of reasons. And so because Kubrick was dead and couldn't get into a battle with the MPAA,
he couldn't
write to them and argue with them and say, here's these 10 other movies you've given an R rating to, and they have this much nudity, and why are you messing with me?
Resubmit and make your case.
Yeah, exactly. He couldn't do any of that. And they didn't want to edit the film down. They didn't want to change the pace of the scene. They didn't want to leave shots out. Their only real choice to maintain the film as close to what his intention was to put these CGI figures standing around, basically just kind of fig leaves, in front of the more kind of explicit parts of the scene.
It's really obvious though.
It's very obvious. It's very, very unfortunate. 1999, the digital effects were not up to snuff. I think today you could probably do it a little better.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just, it doesn't work. And I'm sure also, like, the fact that it was mandated by the studio and it wasn't Kubrick, like, supervising it.
Right.
I'm sure if he'd been around to do it, they could have gotten it looking better. But I also think he would have probably figured out a way to just get it past the MPAA anyway.
Yeah.
You know? So yeah, there are CGI figures. If you get, like, the American DVD from a long time ago,
yeah.
I think by now, if you buy it on Blu-ray, in fact, I know this for a fact, if you buy it on Blu-ray or DVD or stream it online, at this point, I think the NC-17 is, like, the cut that everybody sees.
You can get so full fuck version?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's nothing, like, crazy explicit going on.
Yeah.
There's just, like, some more kind of, like, yeah, it's really not that explicit. It's pretty tame.
I mean, so. You can see what's going on
yeah,
anyway.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's fine.
You know what I had never noticed about the sex scene until this most recent time? I don't know why I never picked up on this, but there's a scene where he walks into one of the rooms and there's a couple having sex. And I always thought they were having sex on like a small table or something.
Uh-huh.
But it's actually a person on all fours wearing like a black suit. They're like
really?
One of the butlers or whatever at this party.
I didn't notice that.
And they are like having sex on the back of this person.
Wow.
And that again just shows you like the power play and the kind of dominance and,
yeah.
and the sort of like, you know, putting people in their place. Like you are nothing. Like you're just
yeah.
like a table for us to screw on, you know. Like, that's what we think of you as a person. It's,
yeah.
It's so, so, like,
well, and there's
crazy.
Something about the masks, too, which, by the way, they're great, great masks.
Yes.
It appears like there is no joy in any of this for
mm-hmm.
any of those
mm-hmm.
people. And it's partially because you can't see expressions. But
right.
no one's, like, partying. Like, there's this bacchanalian orgy going on.
Yeah.
For about a third of the people,
right.
At any given moment.
Yeah.
Because I guess there are only so many girls, but the rest of the people are just standing around,
yeah.
watching, not doing anything.
Very solemn, very
but they're
kind
not
of
like,
serious.
They're not masturbating to
yeah,
it.
Yeah,
it's
yeah,
not
yeah.
like,
yeah.
It's not like the orgies I've been to.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Real life orgies is very different. Yeah.
But, and when he, one of my favorite parts is when he gets told that his when he's totally found out and he says, your limo driver or your taxi driver needs to speak
yeah,
with you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they walk through the saddest slow dance you've
Strangers
ever seen.
Strangers in the Night.
Strangers
yeah,
in the Night
yeah,
playing.
Yeah, yeah,
which totally reminded me of kind of the ballroom scene in The Shining.
Deliberately so, I think, yeah.
And then, but when he walks through, and I've seen this movie 4 or 5 times, but when he's like, oh, sure, I'll go with you to talk mm-hmm. to my taxi driver, and he opens the door, and it's fucking... The
yeah.
everybody,
yes,
just
yeah, yeah, yeah,
looking at him,
yeah.
And just last night, again, I'm getting chills.
Oh,
I was
yeah.
just like, as soon as he walks in that room out loud, I went, oh, fuck,
yeah, you know, you're in some deep shit.
Yeah, and I even like, knew it happened, but
yeah.
it was still so powerful,
yes, yeah,
so creepy.
Oh, it's just that it's that uncanny thing. It's that there's something about the way he composes an image,
yeah, man,
like the symmetry of it, the lighting of it.
Uh huh.
Everybody's in these kind of like darker. Cloaks and he's, you know, the
yeah.
the master of the ceremonies is in the red one in the center.
Yeah.
And you just know like you've arrived at this kind of like tribunal council, whatever.
Yeah, it's
that
so
is
menacing.
Gonna, like, yeah. It's
tonally.
Yeah. It's like you've been called in
uh-huh.
by like the principal, you know, and like you're about
yeah.
to get chewed out. Like,
I'm surprised they let him go because when I first saw it, I thought
he's
like going to get a train
yeah.
pulled on him or
yeah.
suffer the worst sexual
yeah.
humiliation.
Well, they do,
you can
you know,
imagine.
They kind of skip over what happens because they tell him,
remove your clothes.
And then the next thing is he's kind of, I don't even remember what the next scene after that is, but
well, he removes
he comes
the mask.
Home maybe.
Well, the lady stands up.
That's
and it's
right.
Like,
that's
stop.
Right. That's right. That's right. Okay. Yes. You're
but
right.
I'm surprised they let him go.
Yeah.
And he comes back the next day.
I think it's, you know...
It's just crazy.
I guess you could say like if maybe they decided we have to let this guy go because he's tied too closely to the Ziegler's
Sidney Pollack,
and Sidney Pollack's character and it's a little messy if we bump this person off.
Right.
So,
and was he behind the scenes even saying like, hey, listen, I know this guy.
Yeah, yeah,
he's
yeah.
He's a well respected
exactly.
doctor.
It's like we
in
got
over
we,
his head.
We got too many connections here. Like I think the practical thing is, you know, I can talk to this guy.
But why wasn't he invited?
That's a good question.
You know?
Yeah. Well, he's not...
He fits the bill in most ways, I bet.
Yeah, but I think maybe he's a little too common. He's a little too
really even as a, like a wealthy
yeah,
New York doctor.
That's his place. You know, he's
that really shows who they were.
Exactly. They're several tiers above where he's at. You know.
Yeah.
Because I mean, you look at Tom Cruise, Nicole Kidman's apartment. It's a nice place. I mean, it's a very nice place
for New York
and Manhattan. You know, that's millions and millions of dollars, but it's not Sidney Pollack's place. You know? It's not a mansion. It's not. He doesn't have an entire wing of Renaissance.
No,
sculptures and stuff upstairs. Like, you know, Sidney Pollack is many magnitudes wealthier.
Well, I think that's one of the. I mean, this movie has a lot of things to say, but I think wealth and status has a lot to do with it.
Yes,
which is a kind of through line in a lot of Kubrick's work.
Yeah, it's a through line in a lot of his work, and I think this movie, like, you know, we were talking about that book that's in the hooker's apartment, Introducing Sociology.
Yeah,
like I think that is, you know, when you said earlier, like the whole film is about sex. I think it's also about money.
Yeah,
and it's about, you know, money
because he's always buying his way.
Yeah.
Out of things.
That's I mean, even his name, Dr. Yeah. Bill, it's like kind of a pun, you know?
Yeah. Because he's always buying his way out of stuff.
Yeah.
Like whether
yeah.
it's the, I'll pay you two times over rental fee for the costume or wait here in the cab.
Rip up that $100 bill. And
which I was always
like,
what?
can you tape that together? Is that still valid currency?
Yeah, you
that?
Can. Okay. And there's a certain amount of serial numbers you have to be able to read on it to make it like relevant currency or whatever.
But it is sort of like whatever problem comes up, he can just throw money at it.
Yeah.
When Vanessa Shaw says, how does 150 sound? He's like, that sounds wonderful.
Because
that's like nothing to him, you know?
Yeah.
He's like, oh, totally. I would have done like 500, you know, whatever.
Well, and the costume guy, he's like, I'll give you 100 over rental.
Yeah.
And he went 200 and he's like, fine.
Fine, sure.
Like he could have said 1,000.
Yeah,
probably.
Exactly.
And so, he would have just been like, I got to go to the ATM.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's great.
And people have kind of counted up like, tallied up.
Oh, really?
How much money is he spending on this one kind of wild night out?
It was $375 for the costume.
Yeah. It's probably $700 to like $1,000 that he spent.
Yeah.
Like it was nothing, you
know?
Yeah. So he's definitely he's insulated a certain extent from stuff that would worry most people.
Right.
But he doesn't have, you know,
Pollock money.
Yeah.
He's not Illuminati.
Right.
Styled.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of Kubrick's commentary because when we think of, you know, American society, I think our perception is, you know, there's rich people and they're like doctors or lawyers or, you know, that's who like a rich person is. Like they have like the nicest house in the neighborhood.
Rich and wealthy are two different things.
Yeah. But wealthy is like
you
never see those people because they keep kind of a low profile.
Right.
And they live in like a gated community.
Right.
They just they go to, you know, they vacation in the Hamptons. Like you just don't see these people, you know. So there's like this whole other world that like when you're talking about who the really wealthy people in society are, it's something that mainstream American society barely even realizes exists.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's played out for sure with this weird sex cult of wealthy, like clearly deciders of world policy.
Cause I think the idea too is that like, you know, Dr. Bill he's living in this world that is very like conventional. It's also like conventional morality, you know, and even like the sexual jealousy that starts to happen in his marriage is tied to this idea of like monogamy and fidelity and fidelio and all that kind of stuff. Whereas it kind of makes me wonder, Sidney Pollack and his wife, is he really running around behind her back? Or does she know and she's okay with it? Do they have some kind of
is
like
that his wife in the other mask next to him?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, you sort of have this idea that like there's this exchange. I believe it's F. Scott Fitzgerald and Hemingway.
Mm-hmm.
One of them says to the other, are the rich really so different than us?
Mm-hmm.
And the response is, yes, they have more money.
Right.
You know, the idea is that like
– it's kind of that simple.
Yeah. It's kind of that simple. Like money really changes things.
Yeah.
And among the things that it changes, it can change somebody's kind of – moral and ethical outlook on things. So it's like once you're like for Tom Cruise, he has to live in this kind of nuclear family unit where he has the wife, the kid.
Mm-hmm.
But once you kind of ascend to a certain level of wealth, it's like, well, do you have to really be married? Do you have to really like there's so much more that your money can do to buy you out of these situations
right.
that the whole idea of like monogamy and exclusivity right. and all that gets very, very, you know, confused, or can anyway.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, if you're worth probably billions like Sidney Pollack is,
right.
like what, you know, your whole moral calculus is just very, very different.
Yeah.
So it seems like he and his wife, I don't think that she is in the dark about what's going on, you know?
I
Maybe
agree.
She has men that she goes yeah. with or whatever, you know?
Yeah, I totally, totally agree. Yeah. Well, for Cruise and Kidman's part, they always have pretty much been on – they've never come out a ton and talked about, like, the negative experiences. They tried to stay pretty positive and be like, you know, we loved Stanley.
Yeah.
And, like, I think they still worship him.
Mm-hmm.
But Cruise did say, and it closes out this Vanity Fair article from Amy Nicholson, he says, I didn't like playing Dr. Bill.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't like him. It was unpleasant. And this was a year afterward. He said, but I would have absolutely kicked myself if I hadn't done this.
Oh, sure.
Which isn't quite the same thing as saying,
I had a great time. Yeah. I loved it. I'm happy I did.
He's like, it's more of if, well, I would have regretted not doing it.
Fear of missing out, kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
I would have spent the rest of my life saying, what if I'd played that role instead of whoever yeah. did? Yeah, that's true. It's like, you know, he's sort of saying, I love that I got to work with Kubrick.
Right.
Maybe I would have preferred it to be a different Kubrick movie or something, yeah. you know?
What an
maybe,
experience.
Maybe
I
it
bet.
Didn't have to be my marriage that got caught in between it or something. But.
Yeah, and I think no one really knows except those two, because Kubrick had all these private therapy sessions with him as the therapist.
Yeah, they said that he
like
was
like solo
he, they
and
got
his
like really, really deep into their marriage, like yeah. a marriage counselor kind of.
And
yeah.
Tom and Nicole both and Kubrick were all like, while he was alive, were like, this no one is ever gonna know what we all talked about.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just between us.
Take it to the grave.
I mean, this isn't movie making like regular movie making.
No, no.
It's kind of something else.
Yeah. I mean, to me, you know, I think there are some you could probably say like in kind of experimental theater maybe.
Yeah.
Where actors are there's not even a script, there's uh-huh. not even a where it's kind of about performance and improvisation and all
yeah.
that kind of stuff. Like you could probably find some of that going on
right.
between like a theater director and some actors that want to do some really deep
yeah.
personal, almost kind of like psychoanalytic kind of work.
Yeah.
It's almost unheard of in film.
Yeah.
You know, and with actors of that prominence,
uh-huh.
it's like no one's ever done that, you know?
Yeah, they had the time, which that's usually your biggest enemy on a film set is
yeah.
time.
Yeah.
Time and money. And
Kubrick understood that
luxury.
More than anybody that
yeah.
like, you know, yeah, you have to have time. You have to be able to just go follow something through
uh-huh.
until you are 100% completely satisfied with it.
Yeah.
Like nothing ends up on screen that he's not
right.
happy with completely.
Well, yeah. And Amy Nicholson makes a point like that if Tom Cruise is getting panned for his performance and they're doing 30, 60, 90 takes and that's what Kubrick wanted in there out of all those,
yeah.
that like that's very purposeful.
Yeah. Well, we had that conversation during The Shining about, you know, the difference between like take one
yeah.
and take 99 or whatever. When I was looking at some interviews for this, by the time Kubrick is doing the post-production on Eyes Wide Shut,
uh-huh.
we're already kind of getting into the realm of, I think he's still editing on, you know, he's editing on film, he's editing on like a flatbed, but
yeah.
But he does have like the dailies transferred to video.
Right, which he wouldn't let Tom Cruise watch.
Yeah, and so he actually had like a multi-screen heads-up display
oh, wow.
where he could play multiple takes at the same time
uh-huh.
or at least have them queued up to play take one, take 30, take 65, one after another like that.
Yeah.
And he apparently raved about how easy this made it to compare the takes because, of course, when you're strictly on film, you would have to be rewinding the film.
Yeah.
You'd have to be kind of queuing it up. And,
right,
and
right.
there would be like a much larger kind of gap in time
yeah.
between seeing the different takes to where you could kind of – you wouldn't be able to A, B, compare it
yeah.
quite so easily as you could in the kind of digital video, you know, era.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that he kept kind of adapting his post-production techniques,
yeah.
you know, into, as you would expect, as
sure.
he did in every other arena of filmmaking. But
right.
Yeah, even with like the multiple takes thing, you just imagine how difficult that must have been on like The Shining, where it's like, can we right. see number 85 again? Okay, pull up 47 one more time, yeah. and let's also look at 3 and then try to make a decision. It's just, you know, it's wild.
Sad that he died. I wanted another one.
Yeah, yeah, it's...
But, I mean, what a movie to go out on.
Yeah, what a movie to go out on. In a way, I think this movie...
Sort of appropriate.
It's sort of appropriate. It feels like it's him kind of branching out in mm-hmm. a weird way, because he'd never done certainly like a movie that was as attuned to like human emotions
yeah.
and, you know, the dynamics of like a marriage, of a relationship.
Yeah.
That's something that he had talked about going back to like the 60s, mm-hmm. That he wanted to make this kind of film. He had briefly kind of considered, I think, making a film called Blue Movie in the mm-hmm. 60s, which was based on a Terry Southern book, a Terry Southern idea.
Yeah.
Terry Southern that he'd worked with on Dr. Strangelove.
Right.
And there was this whole thing happening in like the 60s going into the 70s of like porno chic.
Right.
Where movies like Deep Throat and
yeah.
so on were kind of playing in like more mainstream theaters. And, you know, it's like that scene in Taxi Driver where Travis Bickle takes her on the date to
yeah.
the porn theater and she doesn't like it. But that's something that like couples were doing a little yeah. more in that era than today, certainly. So Kubrick had this idea kind of from early on that like he would like to make something very human,
mm-hmm.
you know, almost the exact opposite of something like 2001 where
right.
it's the machines are almost kind of the main character
yeah.
in a way. He did have this other side of him that wanted to see real human emotion,
but
jealousy.
But and, as Kubrick.
Yeah, as Kubrick, which is very different.
Base,
you
yeah.
know, it's not like a Bergman film or something,
yeah.
you know. But I think that's cool that he went out on a movie where he was still trying new things.
Yeah.
He was refining his approach from other films, but he was also at the same time trying to do something very different and
yeah.
very kind of, you know, who knows where he would have gone from there, you
yeah.
know? And it is sad that he didn't get to go further. But at the same time, I think this film contains so much of his past films.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many parallels to The Shining,
uh-huh.
to Barry Lyndon. Even 2001, when there's a shot of him walking into the hospital
mm-hmm.
and this revolving door.
Oh, yeah.
It feels very 2001, you
yeah.
know? And knowing Kubrick, I mean, there's probably 100 different revolving door entrances
yeah.
they looked at. And
yeah.
you picked that one in particular that has this kind of space age feel to it.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of these little nods throughout the film where he's kind of, in a very gentle way, looking backwards at
yeah.
all his films, and it feels like he's integrating them all into this one.
Yeah, I don't know if it's retrospective tagging, but it has a feeling of finality to
yeah,
it for
yeah.
some reason.
And I'm sure Kubrick was aware of his own mortality
sure.
to a large extent, and maybe didn't. I mean, one thing that is very strange that I didn't really pick up on until watching it this most recent time is that when he goes over to the patient's house who's passed away,
uh-huh.
and she's talking about, you know, he had such a good day yesterday,
right?
And then he said, "I'm a little tired. I'm going to go lay down, take a nap."
Yeah,
and I went into the room and I was cooking dinner, and then half an hour passed by, and I came in to check on him, and I thought he was just sleeping, and
right.
then I realized. Like, he passed away in his sleep, this
yeah.
character did, but that's also what happened to Kubrick, is he died in his sleep.
Right.
And also in, you know, Tom Cruise is reassuring her, I'm certain your father didn't suffer at all. You
yeah.
know, Kubrick had the exact same kind of death where he passed, you know, gently, like, in his
right.
sleep, and there was no prolonged medical kind
right.
of...
He didn't fight cancer for 5 years.
Yeah, exactly,
years
exactly. So
yeah.
he just kind of went to sleep one night and didn't wake up, you know?
So sad.
It's interesting, though, that he kind of... It happened in the movie, too,
yeah.
you know?
All right, dude. Well, that's it for this one. What do you want to do? Like, part of me was thinking, all right, let's move on and tackle, like, Godard or Truffaut or
yeah.
Kurosawa.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But my head is so in Kubrick.
Well?
That, like, I feel like we should just throw another Kubrick in there and just kind of keep on this train.
I think if we're going to stick with Kubrick, I think the natural kind of next film to talk about would be Paths of Glory.
All right.
Because...
Done.
We'll get into it, but it has, thematically, it has a lot in common with, say, Barry Lyndon, The Shining,
yeah.
Eyes Wide Shut. And
all right, everyone.
It's another piece of that puzzle.
We're going to keep the Kubrick train rolling with Casey. Look forward to Paths of Glory in a month or so.
Yeah.
And I look forward to that. I haven't seen it.
Awesome.
Thanks, man.
Thanks.
Movie Crush is produced, engineered, edited, and soundtracked by Noel Brown and Ramsey Yunt at How Stuff Works Studios, Ponce City Market, Atlanta, Georgia.